As I look over and see the big crowd present, I understand the advantage now of meeting at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. A lot of brethren here from other congregations, some people I've known in the past. And so that's the advantage. Now, there is a disadvantage. 3 p.m. can be nap time. So I think I'm going to have to pound the pulpit and holler a little louder. Now, I'm sure that if you're interested in the things of God, I will try to do the best I can to present them in a way that can keep your attention. But if somebody gets to nodding a little bit, I will not judge. I want to begin speaking about what I call the reaction mode. Man has a tendency to react to other men instead of focusing vertically on God. There's several examples in the Bible we can give of this. I always think of Moses and the Israelites in Numbers chapter 20. In this chapter, Moses had every reason to be angry, to be in the reaction mode. God had liberated Israel from harsh slavery. He'd given them food. He'd manifested himself to them in miraculous ways on Mount Sinai. And yet time and time again, here they are murmuring and complaining. And here in Numbers 20, we have them in the wilderness of Zin. And the same. There's no water that's evident. God had provided them water time and time again in the past. Murmuring. Complaining. God told Moses to go to the rock and speak to it. And as you read verse 9, you can almost imagine the people murmuring, complaining, gathering together, Moses watching them, and you can understand the anger welling up in him after years of frustration. And so he says, "Hear now," this is verses 10 and 11. "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock. What was the sin that Moses committed here? God told him to speak to the rock, and he struck it. Maybe that was a part of it. We have a divine commentary in Psalm 106, 32 and 33, which says that his sin was that he spoke rashly with his lips. In his somewhat justifiable anger, he forgot about God, thought that it all depended on us. Must we get water for you? And the result, as you keep on reading, verse 12, Moses was not allowed to enter into the promised land. So, were the children of Israel in error? Absolutely. That did not justify his rash words. Did they need rebuke? Yes, but not with his rash words. And there are other Bible examples I'll mention briefly. David and Nabal, 1 Samuel 25. Here, you can almost imagine two gangs. "You disrespected me. You disrespected me." David became so angry because Nabal did disrespect him that he wanted to kill everyone involved. He forgot about God and was about to go with complete a massacre until someone with sense, Abigail, came and talked him out of it. He was in what? He was in the reaction mode. Also, I think of David, when David was being chased out of Jerusalem by Absalom. As he's going away with the few loyal soldiers that he had left, here comes Shimei, throwing rocks at him. And the soldiers with David said, "We can take care of this right now. We can go and kill him." David here. Now, David was in the reaction mode in 1 Samuel 25. But in 2 Samuel 16, he's a little more mature. He keeps his soldiers from getting into that reaction mode. And in the New Testament, it appears that the Corinthians were in the reaction mode against the penitent brother who had confessed, who was trying to turn his life around. And yet, they still were not treating him well. We see this reaction mode in the spiritual realm even today, and especially in controversy. We see somebody who's wrong, and sometimes they may use irrational points to defend themselves. And we're so disgusted by it and so concerned about it that we forget to respond as Jesus would have responded. And we lash out, not on the basis of Christ's teaching, but on the basis of what may be a certain type of justifiable anger. I think I've seen this reaction mode often in an age-old conflict between two groups of brethren. One group says that convictions should have priority over everything, over mercy. And they talk a lot about obedience. We must obey, we must obey, and we must. But they talk very little about God's grace and mercy. But then on the other hand, we see those who think that mercy and grace should have priority over convictions. They talk a lot about God's grace and very little about obedience. And so often these two groups point out correctly the excesses of the other group. Those who believe, who talk very little bit about grace and mercy say these people don't even believe in obeying God. And they're right. And those who always talk about grace and never about obedience say, well, those people don't even believe in God's grace. They think they can get all right, and sometimes they're right. And they're both wrong. They're both right, and they're both wrong. They're right in pointing out the errors of the other, but wrong in not seeing their own, and not seeing their own lack of balance. So, this we see in the New Testament. Jude. Verse 4 talks about some who would turn the grace of God, you remember the text, into licentiousness. They wanted grace. They wanted licentiousness at the same time. No convictions. But in Romans chapter 6 and verse 1, some evidently, with the apostle Paul, resented him so much talking about grace. And the idea seemed to be that he's saying, let us continue in sin, that grace was abound, that grace may abound. That wasn't what Paul was saying, but they were interested in keeping their Jewish culture and Jewish traditions. They didn't want to hear so much about grace. And we're seeing it today. As our modern culture moves from being influenced by a more rational approach to the Scriptures, we talked about this earlier today, to a more postmodern approach to the Scriptures. There are clashes that come when we see those two currents meet. I want us to look at three main points in our lesson today, convictions and mercy. First of all, I want us to talk about the danger of emphasizing convictions without mercy. I've got it turned around here. Don't pay any attention to that. The danger of emphasizing convictions without mercy. Let's see what I've got here. I've got it right there. The danger of emphasizing mercy without conviction. I looked over this PowerPoint time and time and time again, and it looked perfect to me. Switch those around, one and two, and we'll be all right, okay? No, it says the same thing just about. Anyway, I'll tell you what we're talking about. Number three, imitating Jesus, the perfect blend of convictions and mercy. Okay, let's see if we get it right up here. Yes. I want you to talk about those who emphasize convictions, a good thing, but they forget to emphasize mercy at the same time. I went as a young man to debate in Kentucky. He was a faithful brother. Well, I just mentioned his name since a lot of you know. Brother Weiser was debating another brother, and the issue was whether women can ask a question in a Bible class or not, or whether they can teach classes of children. The other brother got up. And here, these are the first statements of the debate from him. One of us is going to hell. Either I'm going to hell, or Brother Weiser is going to hell. And after about 10 seconds, it was pretty obvious that he didn't think that he was the one that was going. And I thought, is there any concept here of mercy? Zero concept of mercy. Historian Richard Hughes talks about a brother who went to speak in Cincinnati in the 1930s. And he described the lessons that he was preaching there in Cincinnati as pugnacious. And a preacher there named F.L. Rowe said you know, this is good stuff, but could we use a little balance here? And he asked the preacher if he could preach the next night on the prodigal son. And the pugnacious preacher said, "The prodigal son? Well, I can't preach on that. I've never looked at that before." Think about that a little bit. Here's a man who's been preaching for many years, and he couldn't preach on the prodigal son. Never studied that before. The concept of mercy and grace shown in studies like that were far beyond him. When we have that approach, what are some problems that come from it? Well, it just doesn't take into consideration God's mercy. I love the 103rd Psalm. And I'm going to read verse 10 and verse 14. The whole psalm is great. "He has not dealt with us according to our sins, nor rewarded us according to our iniquities." If God did that, where would we be? If God rewarded us according to our iniquities, or dealt with us according to our sins, where would we be? Hopeless. Verse 14. "He himself knows our frame. He is mindful that we are but dust." He knows how we are. He wants to extend his mercy for us. But we have to seek that mercy. We'll talk about that in the next point. 2 Chronicles chapter 30 is an interesting chapter. Here you have Hezekiah working to restore the biblical Passover feast and the biblical way. And he even wanted to invite those from the scattered northern remnants who were left there in little pockets after the Assyrian invasion. They came, a few came, and yet they did not go through the required cleansing that it was required under the law. The last part of verse 18, 2 Chronicles 30 says, "A majority of the people, many of them from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun, had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover, otherwise than is prescribed." They did not show the due care and caution in going through the cleansing requirements before partaking of the Passover. They didn't obey God. They were presumptuous. Where is the God of Nadab and Abihu here? But the last part of verse 18 through 20, "For Hezekiah had prayed for them, saying, 'May the good Lord pardon everyone who sets his heart to seek God, the Lord, the God of his fathers, even though not according to the sanctuary's rule of cleanness.' And the Lord heard Hezekiah and healed the people." Mercy. Mercy. Now, I know that God would have expected them to, during the next Passover, to do it the right way. And if they'd had a lackadaisical attitude about doing it, we might not have seen as much mercy as we see here. But we do have here a case of mercy. Other examples we could give. David committed adultery with Bathsheba. What was the prescribed punishment for that? Being stoned to death. And people ask the question, why did God not require that David be stoned to death after his adultery? And you can get all kinds of speculations as to why not, but I think the best answer is God's mercy. God's mercy. When we emphasize convictions without mercy, we don't imitate Jesus, and that's going to be our last point, so I'm not going to go into it deeply. But it's not imitating Jesus who showed mercy. It makes issue-oriented congregations not Christ-oriented congregations. I'll explain to you what I mean. I asked a young man who was trying to start a new work in a city, and I knew of another congregation in a similar area, and asked him, "Well, what about this other congregation? Have you had any contact with them?" He smiled and he said, "Well, I know there's good people there, but that's an issue-oriented congregation." Think about that a minute. An issue-oriented congregation. Now, should congregations be issue-oriented or Christ-oriented? Now, a little asterisk here, don't misunderstand me. If we are Christ-oriented, then we're going to be concerned about issues. I think the church at Pergamos should have been a lot more concerned about the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Everything, they're just letting it pass by. And if we love Christ, we're going to educate ourselves on certain issues that may threaten us and threaten others spiritually. But a focus on convictions without mercy usually results in a squabbling, issue-oriented congregation where often there's little desire to imitate Jesus Christ. Another problem. Brethren can sometimes lose heart. I hate to say this. Sometimes I have to explain what I'm saying when I'm preaching along this line in the Northeast where they haven't seen congregations that have problems. But here in Limestone County, we all know of congregations that have suffered serious problems, divisions, and splits. Sometimes it's necessary when others insist upon doing things that violate our conscience and following the Scriptures. Sometimes there's no other alternative but to find another place. I understand that. But sometimes it's just a lack of mercy. It's a lack of mercy. And when people see constant squabbling in an ungodly way. I'm not talking about loving exchange, loving debate, respectful debate. I'm talking about squabbling. They often wander off into convictionless worldliness, subjective emotionalism. Convictions without mercy is not God's way. It brings on disastrous results. Well, let's look at the other side of the story. I want to talk about those who want to emphasize mercy without convictions. And often, people who want to emphasize mercy without convictions are reacting to the extremes that we just talked about. They've seen all the battles about the picky little things. They've seen proud and arrogant people using sarcasm to personally attack those who disagree with them. And they rebel. And here's some of the types of things you will hear from those who want to emphasize mercy but no conviction. Oops, hit the wrong one. Okay. Church organization wasn't the primary focus of Christ. Love was. I don't know if you've heard that one before. And there's a sense in which that's true. But that doesn't mean that church organization is unimportant. It'll lead you to some pretty difficult conclusions if you say it's not. And we'll talk about some of them towards the end of the message. I heard this from a friend here in Athens. Christ didn't die on the cross for a cappella music. Well, you know, I don't think Christ died with reference to any one issue. I think you can say Christ didn't die on the cross for the Lord's Supper, but He wants us to partake of the Lord's Supper. He wants us to remember His death and resurrection. He still wants us to imitate faithful disciples of the first century. There is no pattern. These are statements. This is not true. Remember, sometimes they get to think Gardner said there's no pattern for congregational worship and organization. I'm quoting other people and what they say to say that it's not important to have convictions. They say there is no pattern for congregational worship and organization. Love is the pattern. I think we're going to see in a little bit that there is a pattern. But that's the type of thing we hear. We need a new hermeneutic, a new method of interpreting the Bible. We need to toss, command, example, and necessary inference. For those of you here with us this morning, I'm not going to repeat that lesson. But there's some problems with all of this. There's some basic fundamental problems. It's reacting. Instead of imitating Jesus, we see others. We see their faults. We don't like it. And we get into the reaction mode and not into submission to God mode. It rejects the common sense interpretation of the Bible, saying that you can't understand it. When you say that you cannot understand the Bible using the sense that God has given us, by, as we talked about this morning, by either telling us, by showing us, or letting us figure it out for ourselves, then how do you determine what is right and wrong? That's the fundamental question you're left with. If you're going to reject common sense Bible interpretation, how do you determine what is right and wrong? And yet many who've been raised with the concept that there is right and wrong don't understand the logical consequences of tossing their convictions and tossing the idea that we can understand the Bible using our common sense. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and we'll talk about it right now, by the way. Historically, that leads to apostasy. A brother told me, nothing about church organization or worship really affects our salvation. I'll repeat what he said. This is not Gardner. This is what somebody else said. Nothing about church organization or worship, he used the terms ecclesial order. I say church organization or worship, really affects salvation. Okay. If that's true, what's wrong with the universal bishop? What's wrong with having a pope? What's wrong with holy water? What's wrong with rosary, images? None of those things affect salvation. Why should Luther have left Romanism if nothing about church organization or worship affects salvation? People say these things, don't use the word spout them off, without realizing the logical consequences of what they're saying. And here's the big problem. It just leads us away from Christ and His simple way. This line of reasoning that you've got to look at the logical consequences sometimes helps us with the people who are trying to toss convictions and toss the concept of a pattern. If you don't believe in common sense Bible interpretation, and if you don't believe that there's any patterns for organization or church worship, what are you left with? I prefer, and I'll explain to you what I'm talking about. I prefer, a brother talking with me, this is years ago when I did more of this stuff, he said, there's no real exclusive pattern on how congregations can raise money. And what he was really trying to promote was that we can let the young people wash cars and get money for the church that way. That was the main thing he mentioned. I told him, if there's no exclusive pattern on how churches can raise money, what about church bank? We can take off Bear Bryant's grandson bank and buy into that. Church bank. Church real estate. Church stock market funds. He wasn't quite ready for that. He said, I prefer voluntary offerings, but I prefer. You know, that's not enough to stop the tide of apostasy. I prefer. Another brother said, there's no exclusive pattern for church worship. When people say that, they don't know what they're saying. They don't know the logical consequences of it. And he was asked, what about watermelon for the Lord's Supper? He couldn't say it was wrong. He just got through saying there's no pattern. He said, I personally would not want to use watermelon. I prefer. If you don't have biblical authority, that's all you're left with. I prefer. It just doesn't work as brakes on men's tendency to apostatize. Can you imagine here in the second century, they're starting to have regional bishops. That's historically happened. They're starting to try to control groups of churches. I don't know if anybody tried to oppose that or not. There's not much written about it. But if someone had just said, hey, that's not what we have from Christ's teaching. If somebody said, well, I prefer that we not have regional bishops. I prefer that we not have dioceses. I prefer that we have not have archbishops. Of course, somebody might have tried that, but it didn't work. The apostasy went ahead. I prefer that we not baptize babies. I personally wouldn't recommend venerating images. Is that going to work? The only way to deter man's tendency to apostatize is to simply say that, is this practice from heaven or from man? That's a biblical question. Is it from heaven or man? Is it in the name of the Lord? We're supposed to do everything we do in the name of the Lord. This is something that people who've been affected by postmodernism do not like. Where's the book, chapter, and verse that helps to see that we need to do that? You may see somebody cringe or get shivers when you say that, but it's a logical question that we may have to go through this and sort it out and make sure that we're applying it correctly. And that's what we need, some of that mercy we've been talking about earlier. But to simply say that the cause of all the squabbles that we may have seen in our lifetimes, that there's just no such thing as a pattern for worship, that's going to lead to, of course, distancing ourselves from Christ. It's that Christ's simple teaching about humility, Christ's simple teaching about His simple worship, simple organization. Yes, I'm trying to emphasize the word simple here. That promotes Christ-like humility. You can't have a fat cat in a local church trying to dominate everything or trying to dominate groups of churches that's going to elevate himself if you just humbly follow Christ's teaching. Saying that we need to leave a common sense approach to the Scriptures always, you can underline that, always leads people to human presumption and the pride that always accompanies it. So, you're opening the door for all kinds of things that you don't realize you're opening them for when you say there's no pattern. Well, if neither convictions without mercy nor mercy without convictions work, what does work? And of course, imitating Jesus. Imitating Jesus. Now, Jesus had convictions, and there are several places where you can really see the strong convictions of Jesus Christ as He took on those who would corrupt His Father's teaching. The cleansing of the temple. What would it have been like to have observed from 100 feet away the cleansing of the temple? Here's an imposing figure with country garb whirling his way through this place where all the animals and were sold and money changed. He's turning over tables. You can imagine coins rolling around. I remember that years ago we had coins rolling around. Sometimes somebody dropped a contribution plate. I don't think you'd hear too many coins around. I do see some quarters in there occasionally. But the coins rolling around, maybe you might have some people scrambling for some of those coins. Bleating sheep, lowing cattle, fluttering doves, pure pandemonium. Can you imagine if that happened today? Can you imagine? Now, you say the headlines in the newspaper. Nobody reads the newspaper anymore. But the headlines online. Preacher out of control at church bingo. If there was like anything like a ministerial association in Jerusalem, I'm sure they would have kicked Jesus right out of it. But why? Jesus was a man of conviction. He hated to see His Father's house profaned with all of these things. It should have been a place of prayer. They turned it into a house of merchandise. And we see Jesus' convictions all through the rest of His life. He taught with authority. He was teaching as one having authority and not as the scribes. Matthew 22:19, He condemned the Sadducees. Showed them through logic, which our postmodernist friends we talked about this morning would not like. He showed them that they were wrong. You are mistaken, not understanding the Scriptures nor the power of God. And then, of course, we have His strong condemnation of the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23. Jesus loved truth. Therefore, He hated the systems of men that promoted pride and presumption. But you know what's coming next. Jesus also had mercy. And you see that all through his writings. I am gentle and humble in heart. Sometimes we say, does that mesh with what we just read in John chapter 2? Yes, it does mesh. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. We see His mercy in His dealings with the Samaritans. The Samaritans were probably a mixed race, maybe of the old descendants of the kingdom of Israel, and pagan people that were brought into that place as well. But the Jews despised them. It is amazing to read of some of the nasty things they did to the Jews. and also some of the nasty things that the Jews did to the Samaritans. And yet, Jesus was almost 100% sympathetic with the Samaritans. The parable of the good Samaritan. The only one of 10 lepers healed was a Samaritan. John chapter 4, Jesus and the Samaritan woman. Overall, the attitude of Jesus towards the Samaritans was positive in spite of their doctrinal flaws, and they had a lot of doctrinal flaws. His mercy is also seen in his companions. He was companions with the tax collectors and the sinners. And that earned him the scathing denunciation of the Pharisees. Look, this man, look who he's eating with, the company that he keeps. But it stands as a monument to his mercy that we need to imitate. It's seen in his attitude with the apostles and his disciples as well. These were humble men. Humble men with weaknesses. One time I tried to make a list of all of them. Maybe about 4 or 5 PowerPoint slides in kind of small print. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that this afternoon. But just think of a few. They argued over who was the greatest. They wanted fire to come down and destroy a Samaritan village. They doubted that he could feed them. You know, the Mark chapters 8 and 9, you see all through there, all the flaws that they had. Chasing people away who wanted to see Jesus, the little children in particular. Peter rebuking Jesus. Peter slipping between the waves. Peter denying Jesus. All of them fleeing when Jesus was arrested. That Jesus did not give up on them shows his infinite mercy. And what did he say about them? To the Father he said, I have manifested your name to those who you gave to me of the world. They were yours. You gave them to me, and they have kept your word. How could Jesus say about such weak men, they have kept your word? Here again, you'll find all kinds of theologians trying to give you reasons. And I think the best thing to say is he was just merciful with them. That's the best explanation. He was merciful for them, but they continued to seek him. That's a key. Jesus was merciful towards those who were seeking him. He was not merciful towards those who were rebelling against him. Was Jesus contradictory? Somebody says, it seems like you're talking about two Jesuses here. No, we're talking about the same Jesus. He was the perfect combination of convictions and mercy. And if we're going to imitate Jesus, we have to learn to take on that perfect combination as our own. And it's not easy to determine when to show a little mercy, when to speak a little more firmly, when to condemn harshly. It's not easy. Generally speaking, I think we can say that it wasn't a matter of either having one or the other. It's having both simultaneously, convictions and mercy. But in imitating Jesus, generally his mercy was seen more with those who were down and out, with those who had not had the opportunities that other had had. And in the case of the apostles and disciples, those who were striving to grow in him. His strong convictions, he always had them, but you can see them most when he's dealing with the proud. When he was dealing with those who should have known better. When he was dealing with those who were leading other people astray. And generally speaking, if we imitate Jesus, that's the way it's going to be with us. That's the solution to all our spiritual challenges. Follow Jesus. Imitate him. Imitate him. Imitate him. And to imitate him well, we have to know his teaching. We have to know his actions. We have to know all about him. If we're imitating Jesus, we're not going to get into that reaction mode that we talked about at the beginning with Moses. Look at these rebels. I'll show them. We'll be strong in our convictions. The lack of trust in God's word and our ability to interpret at least the part for babes, the milk parts, that's going to lead to disaster. But at the same time, we've got to be merciful and loving as Jesus was. Don't you ever think that convictions and mercy are incompatible? They're not incompatible. They should be inseparable companions, a part of the package that defines who we are as followers of Christ. May God help us. When we think of people who are trying to approach Christ, often they're frightened off, thinking that they have to know it all and understand it all when they become Christians. God is merciful with us as we grow in Him. We don't have to know it all to become a disciple of Christ. He's died for us. He's lived on this earth for us to give us an example. The question for all of us is, how do we respond? Let's come to Jesus. If we haven't done so yet, you can do so today. Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins. If you've already done that, and yet you realize that in your own life, you've not imitated Jesus. You've not been a good follower of Him. And others know about it. Let us know. We'll do what we can to encourage you this afternoon. Let's stand now and sing the invitation song.